The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 1018. It's the 15th of March 2018. On the podcast today, Peter Bird, CEO of Asia Met Resources, and Peter discusses their £7.2 million fundraise and what it will be used for, including increasing the company's equity position from 40 to 80% in their Butong project. Plus, I also have Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vesarian, VRS, ticker there, and Neil talks about their collaboration with Team Sky to explore the benefits of adding graphene to the high-performance cycling equipment they use. I also have on Michael Laurier, CEO, and Ian Bristow, CFO of Symphony Environmental, SYM. And the guys talk about their preliminary results and the company's products, which includes D2W, very hot at the moment, which makes plastic smart. In other words, it makes it oxo biodegradable, gives it a lifespan, you know. All right, also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers Unilever, Old Mutual, and PZ Cousins, that's PZC. Plus, I also have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Peter Bird, CEO of Asia Met Resources, that's ARS ticker. Peter, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, some significant news out of late, and capital raise, which is cheered by AIM investors. And you know, I did say myself, I've got to say, I do hold some shares in Asia Met, and I did say this is the way to do it. And we've got directors taking on as well, taking advantage of the fundraise, which is always good. Always provides confidence in the project. Before we get into the details of that, Peter, if there's someone listening to this podcast right now who's not heard of Asia Met Resources, can you explain what you're all about, please?
Yeah, sure. So, as you said, Justin, we're an AIM-listed company focused specifically on mining. We have a market capitalisation of just over £100 million. Our focus is in on copper. We have a very strong portfolio of assets located in Indonesia, ranging from early stage exploration right through to feasibility come development. And perhaps, Justin, I might just touch quickly on those assets. The assets are in two geographic locations, central Kalimantan, mm-hmm. and Aceh province in Sumatra. The central Kalimantan project is called the KSK project, and what we have there is a district scale portfolio of copper dominated assets, the first of which is the BKM project. So the BKM project is a project we've been working on over the past couple of years. We've completed a preliminary economic assessment and now in detailed feasibility. The PEA indicated that the value of that project is just in excess of $200 million US dollars, with a very high internal rate of return, about 39%, with the objective to produce 25,000 tonnes of copper cathode, that is pure copper metal, over an initial eight-year period, and then see whether or not we can grow upon that. So it has the current defined resource is just on 432,000 tonnes of copper. And we will aim to deliver the feasibility study, which we've been working on, by the middle of this calendar year, which will be a major news event. Mm-hmm. Surrounding that, we have a whole suite of targets that we need to address in a very systematic manner, but I'll just give you an example of two of those. And the first one is the BKZ project, which is located to the immediate north of BKM. BKZ is a project that we really worked on very hard in the latter part of last year, with a significant amount of very positive drilling results. And we would anticipate delivering a maiden resource on that in approximately May of this calendar year, and just some tremendous intersections of zinc, copper, lead, and the like. If we step out more regionally, there really are many targets which we need to follow up on, hence my comment that this is a district scale area and we're very excited about it. But examples would be Baroi, etc., etc. So a lot of work to do there. So, and in that particular area, as you can see, we've got early stage exploration right through to a project that is come finance and production, being the BKM project, which we would hope to have in production by 2020, calendar year 2020. If we move over to the other, and we have 100% of that, of those projects. If we move over to the other project, the Bouton project in Aceh province, this is quite a different situation. It's a very large scale copper gold resource, of which we currently have a 40% equity interest in. It's our longer term project, and we do in fact have the ability to move to an 80% equity position under the terms of the agreement with our joint venture partners. So just to describe it, a very large copper gold moly porphyry, which currently contains on a 100% basis approximately 2.3 million tonnes of copper. And for those people familiar with porphyries, this is a system that shows affinities with the giant Wafi-Golpu project, which Newcrest have and many others around the world. Like the KSK project, the logistics are very favoured towards us, very good road infrastructure, very good access infrastructure, and in the case of Bouton, a wonderful port and access to a power station. So major upside here for Bouton. Just to give people an example, some of the recent intersections that are in our RNSs, we've got drill intercepts of 384 metres at 0.68% copper and 0.12 grams per tonne gold. And this project remains open both at depth and to some extent laterally. So that's given us sufficient encouragement that we have recommenced drilling at Bouton, and therefore we'll have a flow of information coming from Bouton throughout the course of this year, probably beginning in around April. So that's a summary of us and our projects. And then, Justin, perhaps I can just touch upon the recent capital raising.
Yeah, well, you know what, like I said, often the placing, the P word amongst private investors sends a shiver down their spine sometimes, you know, in certain companies, because it's often done at discount and, you know, sometimes you don't get to any director involvement whatsoever, even the directors are talking about sort of a world-class asset or something like this. It's very different in your respect. I mean, this was cheered, so yesterday a lot of private investors applauded it because it wasn't done at a huge discount. You raised £7.2 million. Directors took part in the placing. So take us through it, Peter. So who else came on board and what's going to be useful?
Sure. So one of the things that the company has done over its history is when it has raised money, it's done it with two things in mind. I mean, the first one, it's always been done around market pricing and at progressively higher prices. So if people look back at the placings that have been done in the company, it's always at elevated prices. So we've been very keen on generating value for shareholders when we have raised this money. In this particular case, as you described, we raised about £7.2 million or $10 million. And this placing did predominantly involve some institutional shareholders, which, as we grow as a business, is another essential sort of plank or addition to what is and will continue to be a very strong and supportive register. And we've had tremendous support from our existing shareholders for a very long time, which is very much appreciated. We see this capital raise as a major enabler for the company, whereby we can now execute our plans, which are quite specific for the remainder of calendar year 2018. And that plan should see a number of value-generating milestones met, you know, for the company and hence its shareholders. So perhaps I can just talk about each one of those in a little bit more detail. So I've mentioned the BKM project, which is in feasibility, where we're completing, you know, as part of that feasibility study, we're completing all our metallurgical test work. We're progressing the environmental impact assessment, you know, doing geotechnical and hydrogeological work. the mine and infrastructure design, engineering, transport, logistics and marketing. And of course, right at the end, which we aim to deliver in the middle of the year, as I said, we'll start working in parallel on the financing piece for that project, which, as I said earlier, has under the PEA evaluation of some $200 million. So that's one of the first, if you like, uses of the funds, and the total amount there is about $3.3 million. As I mentioned earlier, surrounding that, we have a whole suite of projects which need some addressing and follow-up. And I gave an example of the BKZ polymetallic project to the immediate north. We are working on delivering a maiden resource for that by about May of this year, and then we'll do a bit more regional work as well. With respect to Bootong, the very large project, one of the uses of the money is to increase our ownership in the Bootong project. So under the terms of the joint venture agreement, we have the ability to move from 40% to 80% for circa $3.3 million. We are in the process of getting that done now, and that will be, as I mentioned in a minute, a major sort of value driver, where Bootong has over 2.3 million tonnes of contained copper. So it's a very large resource, and I think, you know, as I said, the ability to get in there, drill it, and see whether or not we can expand upon that will be very exciting, with first results, I think, expected somewhere around April of this calendar year. So that's just an example of the sorts of things that we will work on for the remainder of the year. I think it's a very defined plan, which, as I said, it's a major enabler. It really helps us to sort of generate some value for the company in the coming year, and will keep us very busy. But I think in the context of a very strong copper market that many people are predicting to be, running from a supply side into a short position in the not too distant future, we're tremendously well positioned with respect, particularly to BKM, which will come into production when that market is short. Some commentators are suggesting a much stronger copper price, which, of course, we would welcome. But even at current spot prices today, around the low $3 levels, the BKM project looks very attractive. So I think, you know, that gives people a bit of a flavour of what we're planning to do in the next short little while.
Yeah, and on a personal level, I mean, like I said, it's always nice to see directors take part in a fundraise. And, I mean, from your perspective, is it a case of this is a compelling project, I want to take part in this? Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in a more general context, many of the senior people in the company, myself included, heavily incentivized from the point of view of delivering results, and that being linked, to the performance of the company, and hence if we perform well, the company should perform well. So, you know, there's no hesitation in participating, and we're very excited about doing that. Along with everyone, we hope to share in a very positive performance.
Yeah, and also nice to see that, of course, JP Morgan at APIC Group also took part as well, didn't they?
Yeah, so JP Morgan have been very strong supporters, and some additional institutional groups have joined, which I think is wonderful. And I think it's an example, as companies grow and mature and get to certain size levels, it's a natural thing for institutional investors to start looking at and investing in them, and we're sort of right at that junction now. So circa 100 million market capitalization is that's pounds, is when the institutional market can get involved. And but I would stress that we have been very strongly supported and very faithfully supported by a great network of shareholders whom hopefully have done very well. But we hope to continue to generate value from this point here. We really believe that the story has just started, and there's a lot more good news to come.
Yeah, and on Bootong, like I said, it's a very big project. And, at what stage are you at that? Because I assume you'll bring someone else in to partner on this or something, but is that the case?
So Well, with respect to Bouton, as I indicated, our current equity position at 40%, that's about 960,000 tonnes of contained copper to our account. So clearly, if we increase to 80%, that level increases. Our objectives there are quite clear. What we have to do for the remainder of this year is two things. The resource is not closed out. So we, as I said earlier, we've commenced drilling, and we will continue to do that through the course of the year. And there are two parts to that. First is to see whether or not we can, in fact, grow the resource because it's not closed laterally, and it is mineralised from surface to a depth of at least 500 vertical metres, but we have not closed it beyond that depth, and there is every reason to believe that we can push on from there. So I think the first issue is just really trying to find how much more we can find there, and that in itself is a value driver. The second thing is where under our plan for the year, we are going to evaluate that resource metallurgically. So part of our drilling program for the remainder of this year will consider the metallurgy, and that will obviously give us some vectors as to how, in fact, we may exploit the resource going forward. For example, if the metallurgy was amenable, it may be possible to start a small heap leach type operation on the top of it, as in a small starter project. With all of those things undertaken, that will then give us the ability, once we've done that, to consider how we take the project forward. And you mentioned other partners. I mean, these generally are big corporate type projects, but I think we need to fully understand, firstly, what we're dealing with above and beyond what we already have, which is very exciting, and then we can grow upon that and consider getting other people involved if that's the right thing to do at the time.
Yeah, okay. And one other thing before I ask you, for three reasons, Peter. I mean, Liberum have a note out saying, you know, a price target of 20 pence, but the best kept secret in copper. Do you think that? Do you believe that?
Oh, absolutely. I think, and perhaps if I can touch upon that, I mean, as a company, and maybe as sort of rounding this out a little bit, it's a very exciting situation. We've got the capital, so we've got the assets, and we have the team. So let's talk about each one of them. From a capital perspective, we've touched upon the fact we've just completed a successful capital raising for $10 million. So we're very well funded with a very defined plan and budget for value delivery in 2018 in a very exciting copper market. I think the second thing is the assets. We've got an enviable asset suite. It is copper dominated, and we're very excited about copper with exploration, evaluation and development options all to be worked on in this calendar year. We currently have a resource inventory of 1.4 million tonnes of contained copper on an equity basis, meaning that the copper in the ground that we know about currently is 1.4 million tonnes to our account. I mean, that's enormous value, and as I've suggested, we are certain we can grow into 2018 strongly on that base. You know, with some of the exploration we're doing both in the BK in immediate area in central Kalimantan, and certainly at Bouton. So that's the second reason. The third reason is we have a wonderful team at all levels who have done this before. They've developed projects, they've found projects, funded and operated projects. So we'll continue to work very hard this year and with the aim, as always, to deliver on our value-based milestones, which is what we've done in the past number of years and what we'll continue to do.
Excellent stuff. Peter, well, listen, the last thing to do, if someone's listening to this right now and they're not following the story, and like you said, you're at the start of that story, you believe, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yes, well, thank you, Justin. So as I said, very well funded, wonderful suite of assets in the copper market, and a great team who have a proven track record and continue to do it.
Excellent stuff, Peter. Good to chat to you. And hopefully, like I said, you've got a lot going on there. Hopefully, it won't be long till we chat again. Thanks very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Rickett, CEO of Varsin. That's VRS ticker. Neil, thanks for joining me again.
Good morning, Justin. It's good to talk to you from the UK for a change.
Yeah, well, it's quite apt, I suppose, because the news, the positive news you've released is you know, in relation to a company within the UK, and it's Team Sky. We'll get that in a bit. But if there's anyone listening right now, Neil, and they've never heard of Varsin, explain what the company does, please.
So we're an advanced materials manufacturer. We came out of the University of Manchester and the University of Cambridge, and one of the things that we're doing is exploiting graphene and other two-dimensional materials.
Excellent stuff. Well, collaboration with Team Sky, and this is, you know, not just a one-off. We've seen collaborations with a lot of sort of big companies we've done now. I suppose on your board then, in your office, is like the who's who of companies around the world. But take us through this. If people don't know about Team Sky, it's probably worth pointing out, you know, how prolific they are and how successful they are, aren't they, really?
Well, I would say that they're the most successful competitive cycling team out there. Obviously, you know, the Tour de France was a big win, first ever Brit to win that a few years ago. But they've got the bit between their teeth. They, you know, they've got the taste for success. They want to win. They're not out there just to make the numbers up. And for us, it's going to push us. It's going to push them. And the key thing about this collaboration is it's right across the board. It's not just one component in one particular type, you know. And once you start working with these teams, you start to realize, you know, how much they're fixated on just getting that that extra second here or there, and how many different types of cycle for different types of event, whether that's sprinting, long distance, all of these require different things.
Yeah, and the thing is, like you say, they are, you know, the leader pretty much. And when the leader does something like this in a sport where you know everyone is very competitive and they're pretty much all world class athletes, and you try and get any advantage you can, you know, on your equipment, and they're trying to get that extra advantage. When the leader does this, you know, other teams are going to try and follow, aren't they? And in fact, not just with Team Sky, I suppose, you know, with other companies and the collaborations you've done, when they see the leader in that field, and you are working with the leaders in many fields, when they see the leader taking up this sort of advantage or trying to advance themselves in this way, others follow, don't they?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing to remember is that behind Team Sky is a whole load of suppliers, and they're all top of their game as well. So the bike manufacturers, the clothing manufacturers, they're all in there. They're all looking at this technology and they're all thinking, oh, hang on a minute, we'll try it here and let's see how it goes. And if it works, then, you know, there's big opportunities for us. You know, our strategy, and we're very fixated about strategy, we're very fixated about focus, is to have a broad range of applications, a broad range of different customers. You know, big customers are fantastic, but, you know, sometimes they move slightly slower. You know, they're the oil tankers, and then you've got the speedboats, and Team Sky is a speedboat. You know, they want this stuff and they want it now, and they want to push the limit, and they're not afraid of a little bit of risk. They're not afraid of a little bit of failure, provided they can learn from it. And get that little bit of an advantage, and so we're trying to build a portfolio of opportunities that are short term, medium term, and long term. We're trying to build a portfolio of opportunities geographically. Now, obviously, this is very much in the UK, but you know, it's a great opportunity for us to be able to demonstrate this technology. And as you saw with the stuff that went on in the Winter Olympics, you know, this stuff can make a big difference. And you know, for us, it's our ability to be able to demonstrate, and for us to be able to show the world that this technology really does work, and that, you know, you're never going to make money or that much money out of one or two base plates for Olympics, but it shows you what the opportunities are. And now everybody in the composites world is looking at it, going, not only have they come up with the idea, not only can they manufacture the material, but they can actually put it into the application and get that, you know, in a medal winning position. So for us, phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I've likened before on the weekend podcast, I've talked about you, said, well, listen, you are becoming sort of the leader. And you've got a leader like Sky, you know, Team Sky, approaching you. And that says to me that you are the leader, the lead dog kind of thing in this sector. And the other people almost say, you know, they are doing the due diligence, these companies, on you. And so other companies will follow. And I liken you to sort of Right Move in a way. You know, Right Move came on board and people started, you know, it's gathering momentum. And yes, they've had their rivals. But once you get that lead advantage, you know, you can't catch up. And yeah, other estate agents did go with, tried other portals, other groups. But once you get that, you know, first mover advantage, it's very hard to stop that momentum. And do you feel you are like that now? You are, you know, there's plenty of other graphene companies out there, I know, but they aren't signing the collaborations you are signing, you know, and I don't think, well, why, you know, why should other companies now go to what's called maybe a company they don't see as good as you, because you are signing with the big guys? And do you feel like you are getting this momentum that's pushing you ever further ahead of other competitors?
We're not too arrogant to think that we're either the only play out there or that we're the best. You know, we strive to be the best. You know, we're not playing to be second place like our partners here. You know, we want to win. We want to be the leader. Whether we're the leader or not is subjective, and it's down to other people to assess. But what I can tell you is there's a real appetite within the company. We've just come off the back of a two-day exhibition down in London, which is the Materials Research Exchange with Innovate. And when you've got the CEO of Innovate coming round and making a special effort to come and see you, Ruth, and you've got Lord Haskell coming around and he's interested in seeing stuff working, and then you've got all these big companies, you know, they're all coming to you. You can't be anything other than super enthusiastic about what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's not just in this country, like you say, it's, you know, in China, obviously the... unbelievable, the factory of the world, pretty much, and the leader and sort of one of the biggest economies now going to be in the next 5-10 years. And in America, you're in companies there, and in the UK, so it is global. Excellent. And are you still seeing lots of interest, Neil?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first 2 days of this week with the MRE exhibition, you know, we're blown away by the number of different connections and contacts. We were invited there by Innovate, and we support them and they support us. And, you know, you have these big companies, some that we're already working with, some that have departments that we're not working with, but we're working with other departments, and some that we've never connected with at all. And so, you know, I put on my Twitter feed the other day, you know, things aren't going to get easy for a while. We're working harder and harder and harder. And, you know, our CFO's out in China at the moment. You know, I couldn't join him because I had this exhibition, and we've got other stuff going on. We've got one of our guys going to Korea, and you know, this stuff going on all over, you know. So we're in the right place. We've got the right connections. We've got the right contacts. We're doing the right things. We're putting the hours in. And for me, you know, again, you know, I'm still the biggest shareholder. You can't be anything other than really, really enthusiastic about what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's down to us to deliver now. So we've got our investor event on the 28th of March, and we look forward to seeing our investors there and having an open dialogue and seeing what's happening with everything that's going on.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously, when you see sort of potential new clients and you just show them a list of people you are currently working with, they must think, right, that's me. I'm convinced, you know. That's as far as Sky is concerned, then when are we likely to see some of their equipment, you know, with Nanny in it?
We're working hard, is all I can say at the moment. And there's a couple of big events coming up, and we will always try to do everything we can to meet the deadlines and the expectations of our customers. This is it's a great opportunity for the company. It's by no means a done deal, and you know, but we've put ourselves in the right place with the right team, and you know, everybody needs a little bit of luck, this is, it looks like everything is heading in the right direction for this one. So heads down, more work, the guys aren't getting off easily, and crack on with everything that we've got to get on with.
Marvellous. Well, Neil, one last thing, you know this, and if someone's listening right now and likes the sound of Vesarion but are not yet following the story, but want to start to, and I want to add you to their watch list, give them 3 quick reasons why they should do that.
Okay, so graphene is one of the fastest growing sectors, one of the most enthusiastic, and we're right in the center with them, with that whole thing, you know, that whole revolution that's going on. The second one is that we have the right partners. We have Innovate UK, we have the graphene flagship, we have the University of Manchester and the University of Cambridge. We couldn't be any better placed. And the third thing is that we're now starting to see more and more of these collaborations come to fruition, which means that it's a hugely exciting time for our shareholders and that you'll be able to see these products actually in action.
Excellent stuff, Neil. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Michael Laurier, CEO, and Ian Bristow, CFO of Symphony Environmental. That's S-Y-M ticker. Guys, thank you for joining me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you've had your preliminary results out, and we'll get to the detail in that in a bit, and some of the outlook for the company. And I'm quite well aware of the company and in a very hot space right now. But before we do that, Michael, for someone listening who's not aware of or not heard of Symphony Environmental Technologies, summarise, please. What's the business about?
Okay, this business is all about supplying a solution that resolves the plastic waste issue that the government is put in their autumn statement as of yesterday, that the environmentalists are concerned about, that the whole world that seems to be concerned with plastic pollution. Our technology, additive, goes into ordinary plastic. It makes that plastic degrade and biodegrade in a very short period of time. That's the primary focus of this business, in addition to some other very interesting technologies that effectively makes plastic smarter.
Yeah, and this makes sense to me because I wrote a blog on you recently, and I was saying that, you know, the plastic industry is a huge industry. And in fact, I think the Green Alliance came out recently with a bit of news saying you can't just abolish plastic. It's a major part of industry. What you need to do is deal with the waste or the plastic litter. But also what you're doing, I think, makes sense because people can't just change the way they operate overnight. And surely the solution is to make plastic smarter. And So I assume you're getting a bit more traction, a bit more interest around you now because of the environment we're in at the moment. But let's go through some of the financial highlights from the results. This is for the year ended 31st December. So I suppose we're going over to Ian. Ian, take us through some of the highlights, please.
Yeah, hi, pleased to. Well, we had a great year last year. We increased our revenues by over 21% to just over 8.2 million. Gross margins around the 50% mark, contributing £4 million to the company. Profit before tax increased by nearly 250% to £430,000 for the year. What is interesting in there is our EBITDA before R&D increased by nearly 60% to £1.2 million. We spend about £600,000 a year on R&D, and these costs, although we have only commercialised a couple of products so far, it's a large pipeline of products to commercialise in the years to come. One of the main factors is our cash generation. We generated over £1 million last year. We left the year with £600,000 in the bank, with no borrowings, and also a capital reconstruction on the balance sheet, which leaves us with a distributable reserves position at the end of the year.
Excellent stuff. Well, Michael, back to you. Let's explain a bit about the technology. That's, I mean, like I said, you have got several products, but I think it's the D2W, isn't it? The one that makes plastic smarter. How does it work? And just explain that for people, if you could.
Okay, so D2W is what we describe as a master batch, or to some people, an additive that goes into the ordinary plastic production process. And that additive of ours, which goes in normally at 1%, through a process of oxidation will allow the product to oxidate and the molecular weight to drop and convert the plastic material very rapidly into a biodegradable material, which is then bioassimilated in time. So it's a form of organic recycling is what we're doing. And interestingly, we have a few countries like Saudi Arabia in the last few months that legislated to make this technology compulsory by saying that all plastics, whether you're wrapping flowers or you have garment covers or shopping bags or garbage bags, must be made in this type of technology. So countries like Saudi Arabia have actually resolved their plastic pollution problem by forcing all manufacturers to use an approved additive. And what we announced to the market last year was that we have that approval. We're one of the very, very few companies that do have that approval.
Yeah, well, and isn't it, to a certain extent, it's in my eyes, I did write a blog on you, like I said, it's a bit of a no-brainer because, like I said, plastic is a very handy, product, and it's been used widely, of course, and because it's proved so well, you know, since it was invented, it's really caught on, and it works very, very well. The only issue is, like you say, it doesn't degrade, and so now you've brought this in. So I don't understand now, I assume since the Blue Planet, you know, put that episode out and it got worldwide sort of coverage, I assume now you're getting more interest. And if you are, what are the resistant points, or where are they? What stops sort of manufacturers just adopting what you've got here?
Okay, there's nothing to stop them adopting what we have. But our first task is to educate the governments that this is a viable solution. And it's a solution that requires no change in the manufacturing process. And it also makes no change to the characteristics of the plastics, other than to control the end of life of that plastic. So communicating those messages, which we're doing on a global basis, and that is why most of our sales are outside of Europe and the United States. We're moving in countries like Africa that desperately need plastics for things like water pouches. They desperately need those very, very thin gauge carrier bags to do various different important everyday tasks with. And they can't afford replacement items that may cost many times more and that don't really biodegrade. So our success so far has been in the countries that have looked at the technology very quickly, looked that it's easy to use, and have applied it to everyday products.
Yeah.
And so our task at the moment in Europe and the United States is to try and governments, because people would not make those changes unless the government does them.
Absolutely. And I mean, are you making headway in the UK and EU and in the US?
Yes, they're listening to us. We've got ongoing meetings. We've had good dialogues with the British government. We've had good dialogues with quite a number of other governments that are extremely concerned and looking for very, very fast answers to resolve the problem. So far as the UK government is concerned, they've been receptive, but we yet to see them actually move forward with some positive actions. In the meantime, we're quite happy with our overseas situation, where we've actually got legislation behind us. And I mentioned Saudi Arabia a moment ago, but that adds to Pakistan, which is a population of 200 million people, more than we have here, and consumptions of plastic far more than we have here. So we're already in some very, very big markets where legislation is forcing this thing to happen. So that's why you're beginning to see a tick up in our sales and our revenues, and fits well into a business that's operationally geared.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent stuff. Well, it's very interesting. And as far as a cost is concerned for the people producing the plastic, does it add a lot to their bottom line cost-wise?
So far as cost is concerned, as I said, there's no interruption to the processing, and the final cost of the product maximum is usually about 5%. Some people can actually put it in for no cost by adjusting their variables through the manufacturing process. So tiny, tiny in terms of cost, which is not the case if you switch to a paper bag, which is not particularly environmental as people think, or to a cotton bag or a jute bag, or to some of the other alternatives. So staying with plastic, which was the first point, it's not going to be banned, because if you start banning it, you end up with food waste and food contamination and medical contamination going through the roof. So there needs to be a balance, which is what some of the MPs are saying. We can't go for an outline. We've got to be sensible by these restrictions and encourage the use of more eco-friendly products. So far as we're concerned, we have our data. We've proven that our product degrades. It biodegrades. It doesn't create microplastics. It's recyclable. And it's a no-interruption solution, and it's effective and it's immediate. So we tick all the boxes. Yeah. So to us, to the Symphony team, we think there's only one way we can be going, and that is moving forward very strongly in all these markets that we've developed.
Absolutely. And one final question. I mean, do you have much competition out there?
Our competition is pretty limited. It's mainly coming from the bio-based industries. But it's important just to say that we're also a company that is not a one-product company, and what we haven't raised during this interview is the exciting developments that we have on our antimicrobials, our flame retardants, our corrosion inhibitors. They're all new markets where we're showing negligible revenue in 2017, and we've got a lot of customer-led projects that we believe will produce revenue during 2018. And one of those areas which we did announce to the market was the treatment of water in the antimicrobial in Pakistan for one of the largest pipe producers. And the other was the launch of a finished product using antimicrobial so far as household rubber gloves is concerned. And those have been already delivered into some major retailers in Europe and one retailer here in the United Kingdom. So there's finished products in our antimicrobials, which we expect to launch during 2018. So far as competition is concerned, there is some, but in both areas, incredibly weak, not brandy that we have.
Excellent. Okay, well, if someone's listening to this, Michael, and likes the sound of what you're doing at Symphony Environmental, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
So the three main things that I would encourage people to look at when they look at Symphony is this is a hot topic today. Everybody wants to fix the problem of plastic pollution. This is a proven technology that works, that does exactly that, number one. Number two is the technology that's now got legislation behind us pushing forward the top line. And that feeds into one of the most important aspects. It's the distribution network model, and we're operationally geared. So for every million, if you like, that goes onto the top line, which is not an impossible task to achieve, half of that is basically falling into the bottom line. So we don't need to double up our cost in order to double up our turnover. And the offering is a major, major thing to consider when looking at a company like Symphony.
Excellent stuff. Well, it's good to chat to you, Michael and Ian, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Hello. Yes, good morning. Very well, thank you. Very well.
What's the news out there?
So we've got to start with Unilever. My goodness. I mean, Unilever, you know, everyone knows that they're sort of a combination company, an Anglo-Dutch company, got heritage from both the UK and the Netherlands. What some people may not know is that they've had this dual listing structure. You could buy PLC shares in the UK, or you could buy NV shares in Holland. And they've sort of thought about it, and they think that actually they don't want to have that anymore, that sort of complex dualist structure. It means duplications on everything in terms of reporting, in terms of disclosures and regulation and all of that gubbins. So what they've decided today, and it's, as they put it, nothing to do with Brexit. You know, we can debate that. Maybe that influenced it a little bit. Who knows?
The thing is, I don't know what's going to happen, though, is that, you know, Remainers will say it's everything to do with Brexit. And Brexiteers will say, no, they've said it's nothing to do with Brexit. So,
Precisely. I mean, who knows? But, I mean, at one level, we all want simplification in companies. We all want them to control their costs, because controlling their costs means, guess what, more profits flow down to our shareholders. So at one level, simplification is good. They've decided to go to a single structure, like most companies, and they've decided to domicile it in the Netherlands, in Rotterdam. So what this will mean in practical terms is that the structure will change. There will still be a listing on London. Of course, many companies have their primary listing in other countries and a secondary listing in London, and that will happen with Unilever. They'll also have a listing in the States. However, it is a change, and it will have some implications. I think certainly the orientation of the company will naturally start to go a little bit more European. And by that, I mean sort of the shareholder base, the focus in terms of the communication. You know, they'll retain important divisional headquarters here in the UK, lots of employees, plants, etc. But the company's evolving and shifting a bit. So the question is, should you sell your Unilever shares? And the reality is, of course, you shouldn't. You're still going to have a stock that's listed in London. I think there'll be a little bit less liquidity, but there'll still be, you know, perfectly okay liquidity for the average London investor. The company's focus will change a little bit, but the reality is London's a very international market. Companies ebb and flow on the exchange. You know, this is not some kind of huge negative in terms of the sort of the direction of the London sort of attractions of the London market versus other things. This is just something that happens. I think for Unilever, it's a very sensible thing to do. It cuts their costs. And, you know, that's that. There'll be new things, new listings, new companies attracted to the London market in due course, so long as, you know, in the post-Brexit world, we don't kind of put up the walls or barriers or isolationist whatevers. That's just the way it is in capital markets. So don't panic. It's not going to particularly impact your Unilever shares. I think as an investment, Unilever's not actually that attractive at the moment. I think we talked about it a few months ago at the sort of the kind of the height of the post-Kraft bid enthusiasm and the changes in efficiency evolutions they were making. And the shares looked expensive north of £40. And I'm not surprised to see them roll over quite a bit in recent months. I don't own them today. I don't find them particularly cheap where we are. So, you know, the reaction to the delisting or if you like evolution of the domicile has been quite muted, and quite correctly so.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they stay above that 200-day moving average, and they're heading towards it. It's 37.92 at the moment, and that is at that's at 37.80, and if it goes below that, then I suppose the next support level will be about 36 odd, 37 pounds. So yeah, and a couple of facts about Unilever here. I didn't know this. Unilever's dual headed structure existed since 1930, when Dutch margarine firm Uni merged with British soap maker Lever Brothers. So Unilever.
Yeah, that's right.
And they say it's not about Brexit and their own things like Pot Noodle, Ben and Jerry's, Marmite, loads of stuff, don't they? So,
And big emerging markets business, and, you know, a bit like, I mean, you know, companies like Shell also have this sort of slightly cumbersome structure as well. It's all to do with history and historical allegiances and alliances and stuff like that. It's just the way it goes. I wouldn't panic about it. And you can see by the reaction of the shares today, it's not going to change anything in a practical sense. It's just one of those shifts that companies do.
Marvellous. Okay, what's next, Chris?
Well, talking about shifts of companies, Old Mutual, a FTSE 100 company, always been a bit of a conglomerate with interests in Africa, in global fund management, in wealth management, all sorts of businesses have had their fingers in all sorts of pies.
Yeah.
They announced about a year and a bit ago that they were going to split up the business, I think quite sensible, and they've sort of announced a further kind of timetable focus today. So everything's on track for the formal split by the end of this year. And what you're going to get, if you're an Old Mutual shareholder today, you're going to get an exposure to an African focused business, you know, Old Mutual Emerging Markets, which is very Africa focused. There's going to be a separate distribution of their investment in a company called Nedbank, which is a South African bank. And then the third part of the business is Quilters, which is the Old Mutual wealth business here in the UK. And this simplification, I think, into, or at least split of the business into three constituent parts, I think is long overdue. You know, conglomerate structures are difficult for people nowadays. People want focus. They want simple businesses they can understand and which managements can run coherently. And we all know the sort of the literature on spin-offs. They tend to be remunerative because guess what? If a company gets a bit more focus, the local management, the management in charge of a division can maybe run it better without sort of some big distant headquarter office sort of overseeing them and making strange decisions or stuff like that. So typically spin-offs or split-ups of companies tend to be remunerative. Now, people know this. Old Mutual shares have romped in the last few months and they're trading a little bit above book value as we speak today. I think, you know, they factored in some of the good stuff. Now it becomes much more technical and fiddly. And my feeling would be, if you are an Old Mutual shareholder, you've got to decide whether you want to wait and get your different shares in different businesses at the end of the year, or whether you're going to sell up now and say, right, once the end of the year comes and these businesses get split up and spun off, then I can decide whether I fancy investing in a UK wealth business, an Africa-focused business, or looking elsewhere generally. And that latter approach would be my preferred one. You know, I'm going to, my feeling is here at around sort of 250-something, there's a little bit of resistance. It's trading above book value. It's had a wonderful run. It was 180p not so long ago. I'd be tempted to cash up and then say, right, what do I fancy owning? What bits do I like? Do I want the Africa-focused bit, the wealth bit, or whatever, in due course?
Yeah. Listen, they tried to top that 260 level. They didn't go get there twice. They've tried to do that. And they've dipped below the 200-day moving average. I'm looking at an hour chart there. Let's have a look at a day chart. 260s, they've tried to dip by that. So you think, they're not going to do it a third attempt. So I think you may see a bit of weakness here. So
that'd be my opinion. And I think typically what will happen is I think they'll add value over time from the different bits being spun off and being maybe a bit more entrepreneurially run. But that takes time. And you can choose which bit you want. I mean, Quilters is a proud name in UK wealth management. You know, that's if you want a bit of that. You can have a pure play on that. The Africa business is interesting, some great positions in things like the insurance markets, which are always growth areas in emerging markets as they become wealthier. People need to insure themselves, household, cars, etc. Insurance is generally a good business to be in that sort of burgeoning emerging market scene, etc., etc. So one to watch, but I think it's sort of done the classic sort of move already, anticipated some of this excitement already. It's going to chill a bit. Let's get the technicalities over and then we can kind of go from there.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? A friend of mine down the road, whose daughter goes to the same school as my son, works in Old Mutual down the road here in Southampton. So, it's something for us to chat about anyway, what he thinks of it. So, marvellous. But by the way, I was talking about the Unilever chart earlier. I was looking at the hourly chart, the 200-day moving. They are way below the 200-day moving average on a daily chart. So you'd suggest in a downtrend, but doesn't look very... maybe we should just, stop buying their products now. They've left us. Just buy British, yeah? Maybe that's what we should do.
Well, the thing is that with Unilever, it's all wrapped up in this big bid from Kraft last year, which they turned down, but they come up with this surprise turnaround plan, which they just sort of pulled out their back pocket, but hadn't told shareholders about beforehand. And I just felt that they should have taken the Kraft bid, in my opinion. I think it was the right deal at the right time. That would have been 40 odd something quid a share. When it went sort of to a premium to that, it just felt overdone. Yeah. So where we are now, it reflects the fact that they turned down the bid and they're chugging under their own steam. And to be honest, I just always felt it was a bit expensive. You know, when companies bid for other companies, they tend to pay a premium. And at the moment, I think that discount to that bid price is just not really high enough. So I would be chilling on this one and looking elsewhere, irrespective of whether they've decided to prefer Rotterdam to the UK as their primary domicile.
Marvellous. Okay, anything else, Chris?
Well, we talked about Africa a couple of minutes ago. We've got a finish up on PZ Cousins, obviously well known for a variety of soap brands, Imperial Leather and Cousins, a variety of tanning sort of solutions, Saint-Tropez and others, which I obviously know nothing about. But it's a business which has a significant emerging market focus, despite a lot of those brands obviously being sold heavily in the UK too. Very big in Africa, particularly in Nigeria, where they've got a number of production plants, but also important selling opportunities too. And it is the latter area which has sort of slightly nobbled them today. They said that the Nigerian economy is difficult, spending is tough, they've hence built up lower sales, more inventories, it's not good, profits are going to be below expectations, and obviously this is all coming at a time when their core UK market is not as easy. Funnily enough, even things like soap and tanning solutions, that they're consumer products, people change around, go to cheaper brands or don't choose to buy stuff, etc. So the UK is under a little bit of pressure for them generally, but this Nigerian sort of disappointment has been the major impact today. Profits below expectations. Shares got rightly shanked early doors. I think they're still down 14-15%. But I took a quick look at the chart, and I don't think the shares have been this low since 2010, which is a striking stat for a company which most people would say medium term, their focus on sort of the UK plus significant emerging market sort of sales exposures would actually be absolutely correct and strategically right. And I would agree with that. So it's a share I don't own. In fact, I don't think I've ever owned it. It's a little bit illiquid. It is a billion quid company, but the shares are quite tightly held, which is hence why maybe they've dropped off so quick today. I would dub this one interesting. Clearly, you're buying into a still uncertain environment, but I have to say, when I look at the products, the business, where they're going medium term, The fact that they're a prudently run company as well in terms of balance sheet and stuff. This one feels like of great interest to me around here as a sort of a contrarian attempting to sort of pick the bottom. Always difficult to do that sort of potential long exposure.
Yeah, interesting. There's a gap down, obviously, today. Went down to sort of yesterday closed at, what did it close at? 276. And today it pretty much opened at 220, went down to 199, and now it's 236. It's bounced a bit. It's been like a cork in water, but I'd say it could retest that £2 level. A nice round number to retest, you know, and come
on. It is. And it used to be that back in the day, I remember once opining that. As I've never owned the stock, but obviously sometimes people ask me about it or I have a think about it. And I remember saying once before that below 300 pence was a level where you should be, you know, dusting down PZ Cousins. So the fact that we're talking now about 200 pence is kind of interesting to me. I think the Nigerian downtrading, the problems in the UK, just from general economy perspective, yeah, you know, that is the reality. That's what it is. But ultimately, yeah, maybe there's an opportunity building here. So it's one I'm going to be doing a bit more work on later on. But I have to say, it's piqued my interest.
Marvellous, Chris. Good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll chat again. Well, I say hopefully. That sounded quite ominous, that. But yeah, let's chat again next week.
Sounds a good plan. See you soon.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Active Energy Group. Easy for me to say. Active Energy Group. That's it. AEG. At four, Angus Energy. ANGS. At three, Vodafone Group. VOD. Quite surprising, that. I don't know why people are following Vodafone. Let me just check their chart, because bigger companies aren't generally, you know, hugely followed here. Where are they at? Oh, they've had a bit of coming down last few sort of weeks, I suppose, from then to £2 odd now. Good support level, £2 by the looks. And they've been up £2.40. It's not a hugely volatile stock. Still don't understand why they're highly followed. At one, another company began with V. It's VR Education Holdings, VRE. And number one, most followed company, had a massive tax bill, apparently, and then dropped off the bottom of the chart. It's Conviviality, who own the outlets. Cheap booze. Do you want some cheap booze? What kind of a cheap booze shop? Booze is cheap. So it's CVR, Conviviality. They're suspended, I think, at the moment, aren't they? But you can still follow them. I'll read up on them, see what's happening there. But look at that drop yesterday, or day before yesterday. One, two, yesterday, day before. It went from £3.10 to £1.15 in one session. That is a heck of a drop. All right, here's the time for the top five most liked RNSs in the last 24 hours. At five, Rehobold Resources, issue of options. At four, MySquare Limited, a strategy card game launch. At three, Vast Resources, further update on proposed 9.5 million prepayment offtake with Mercuria. At two, New Orleans Gas, further update on proposed, sorry, that is it's wrong there, fundraising. They did 1.5 placing, I think. So I misread that. In fact, it's wrong on the page there, but I'll change that. And number one, most liked RNS, came from Georgian Mining Corporation, GEO. That's 2018 work program for and MOU for production. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciatos.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz. Discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.